support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian.
The first time I went to Sierra Leone, a little over a year ago, I was really hit by the extreme poverty of the country. Lack of running water, lack of electricity. I know that's a common feature in sub-Saharan Africa. But what was also extremely interesting was the overwhelming sense of optimism in the country. That this was a country 10, 11 years after civil war that was finally getting back on its feet. Things that were moving and progressing in the right direction. Foreign investment was returning, mines were opening, and there were even green shoots of tourism with those wonderful, wonderful beaches on the western coast. So anyway, that was my first and only time in Sierra Leone, and little did I know that a year or so later, I was going to be inundated with emails from people I had interviewed begging me to bring attention to the Ebola outbreak. So when I spoke to the director of operations at Médecins Sans Frontières at the beginning of August, and he told me that the world's response was completely inadequate, I understood where he was coming from. Sierra Leone is one of the most vulnerable countries in the world, dependent on foreign aid, despite having natural resources such as diamonds and rare minerals. There's been lots in the media about the crisis. There's been hysterical reporting in the US about the threat to their own citizens. There's been plenty of debate in the media, at the UN, about how to achieve the beginning of the end and how to contain the crisis, including the efficacy of a lockdown in Sierra Leone. Here's the president of Sierra Leone, Ernest Bai Koroma, just before the lockdown began in September.
Médecins Sans Frontières, they may be right in what they're saying, but I'm told they're only talking about it from the curative point of view, looking after the sick, they are caregivers. What we are more concerned about is the social mobilization. 0.02% of the population, that is about just 1,000 people, have been affected by this. We still have 5,999,000 people who have not been affected. These are the emergency. These are the ones that we must keep safe.
The number of dead had surpassed 3,000 at the start of October, more than the combined death toll of all previous outbreaks since 1976. Many are calling for more and more resources to be thrown at the crisis, like Professor Peter Piot.
From my perspective, what can they do? We have to. This is an enormously complicated logistics job. And frankly, the military are, together with DHL and so, are very good to do this. And then, in addition...
DHL, did you say?
Yeah, I mean, all these companies that are into logistics and transport and delivery, they are... I think they would be extremely useful, but we also need doctors and so on. And I think that the NHS and universities, just coming back to the UK, we should make it possible for nurses and doctors who want to do this to volunteer and to work then in an organized way with through, for example, MSF and so on. I mean, you need a structure to work in.
But behind the headlines, what is happening in Sierra Leone and neighbouring Liberia?
My name is Robtel Paley. I'm Liberian. I'm a PhD candidate at the University of London School of Oriental and African Studies. I think there's a lot of anxiety, a bit of hysteria, because they don't know what the next day holds. I remember having a conversation with my aunt when I was in Liberia in July, and a question she asked me when we were sort of sitting at home trying to figure out what was going on was, she was there during the course of the war, and they dodged bullets from one county to another, from one city to another. Now at this stage, something like Ebola is going to kill them. I mean, she couldn't understand how it could get to this level. At least during the war, you could see the moving targets. You could see the bullets. You could see where the destruction or where the possible danger was coming from. At this stage, no one knows. And I think that level of uncertainty is what makes the situation so intense. I'm in touch with my family almost every single day, and they're trying to stay calm, they're trying to stay prayerful, and I think that's pretty much what they're holding on to, is this impeccable faith in God that at some point their prayers will be answered and this thing will go away.
For all the progress that has been made in West Africa, what weaknesses has Ebola exposed in the development of countries like Sierra Leone and Liberia? how far will the disease hit the fragile and underfunded healthcare system? With civil war a recent memory, how much trust do citizens have for national government and the West? And can anything come from the media's renewed focus on the region? I'm Lisa O'Carroll. This is the Global Development Podcast. Stay with us. Let's start with health and this report by Monica Mark, who has recently been meeting doctors in Sierra Leone.
On the coast of West Africa, Sierra Leone has suffered the second highest number of fatalities in the Ebola outbreak. By the end of September, some 600 people had died out of a total of just over 3,000 recorded deaths across Sierra Leone, Guinea and Liberia. But a recent quarantine here revealed dozens of undetected cases, and health officials say the numbers may well have been underestimated all along. Although Ebola is deadly and contagious, it's also actually easily containable. And so to understand how it had been able to spread so far in Sierra Leone, I spoke to Mohamed Dila, a doctor in Freetown who runs a maternal health program. Maternal and neonatal health statistics are a good beacon to gauge in a country's overall health system. Sierra Leone languishes at the bottom of every index for both maternal and neonatal health.
Before the Ebola crisis, there have been challenges around making sure health facilities had the right staff, for instance, like midwife. We're not talking high tech, we're not talking even doctors, we're talking about nurses, we're talking about midwives. The health facilities that did not have doctors, that did not have midwives, that did not have nurses, the health facilities that did not have drugs, and in a country where, you know, water is so available, many health facilities had very, very poor infrastructure relating to water availability and sanitation, and worse still, even electricity. You know, so I think when we talk about that, we're talking about a country that probably haven't turned around the issue of the civil war, a country that is faced with a very fragile health system.
Almost half of Sierra Leone's population of 6 million is under the age of 18. I asked Roland Monner, country director of UNICEF, what impact the outbreak is having on the country's children.
Going up again, the impact on children is dramatic because, you know, the symptoms for Ebola, the first symptoms are very similar to preventable diseases like malaria, diarrhea. And as a result of that, because of the fear and the anxiety, parents are not taking their children anymore to a clinic. Well, we've, as UNICEF, worked so hard to get malaria, anti-malarias, anti-diarrheas, pneumonia medicines to all clinics. We distribute to all 1,200 clinics. We supply them with medicines.
And unfortunately, that impact goes far beyond the health sector.
Kids are not going to school, so they're missing their education at a very important phase in their lives. But secondly, schools are also a safe and protective environment for them. They roam around, but it's in the school compound and people are looking at them. Now all these kids are out there in communities which are all in a heightened alert and anxiety. So protection issues are there as well, child labour issues. So it's not good. It's very bad, actually.
But even if schools do reopen and the outbreak slows down, it's likely to take a long time before Sierra Leone recovers completely.
The health system will take some more time, I think. We need to, also people need to, and that's also part of the work on social mobilization we're doing, people need to get trust the system again, sort of confidence in the fact that they can go to a clinic. That might take a bit longer.
That was Roland Monash, country director for UNICEF. So what are the long-term solutions for healthcare? Matthew Clark is the director of the Wellbody Partnership in Sierra Leone. He spoke to The Guardian's Hugh Muir.
Well, I think that the solutions are complex and part of a kind of chronic problem with the healthcare system. And I think that it takes a long time to train doctors, to train nurses and build up a functioning healthcare system. And I think in Sierra Leone, you have a good medical school that produces young doctors and you have several good nursing schools that produce your good nurses. The challenge is that these healthcare professionals leave and qualify into a fairly dysfunctional system where there isn't any senior doctors, senior nurses to support them, or there are very few because those people tend to have left either during the war or to seek better professional opportunities overseas. So you have these very junior, very enthusiastic, very committed people start to work in a system that doesn't function. They've got no one to refer to for advice. They've got no support for themselves if they want to progress in their career. They, up until now, have had to leave the country to seek specialist training. So I think until you build up a system where young doctors and nurses can qualify in Sierra Leone, can see an opportunity and a future for themselves, and that the system supports them and nurtures them to become the kind of health leaders that they need to be, whether that's in oncology, pediatrics, it doesn't really matter what special psychiatry, what specialty they're doing. What you need is a system where people can leave medical school, leave nursing school, and establish themselves as the senior doctor.
Presumably when people get to that stage, they then start looking abroad because they can take themselves abroad and they can do well.
Exactly. And I think even before they get to that stage, to actually get that training and that sort of experience, it's almost impossible to get that in Sierra Leone. So very early on in their career, they start to look either within the West African sub-region or further afield. And then, of course, like everyone else, the incentives to come back to Sierra Leone as they, you know, at the time when they'd be most effective, which is probably in their mid-30s to mid-40s, then they have families and children. It's very difficult then to suddenly relocate your life back to Sierra Leone. So I think until we address that central problem of not just thinking about we've got 20 doctors, 100 doctors in the country, but actually what are we doing with those doctors and how are we kind of turning them into the leaders of the future, is going to be very difficult to tackle any of these problems, whatever disease.
So that's a problem that's bigger than the health service in a way, because to create the conditions so they would want to stay, that's about conditions in the country. That's about the stability of the country, isn't it?
I think in part, but I don't necessarily accept that it's just about that. I think if you could, you know, there will be some people who want to leave because of the system at large, and there are some people who want to leave purely for professional reasons. And I think you're right. To create a utopia where every young doctor just wants to stay in Sierra Leone because it's perfect, I agree, is a big challenge. But actually, I don't think it's beyond the kind of commitment of the international community and other partners to actually say we're going to look at this as a 10-year problem, and we're going to think about how do we strengthen the healthcare system over 10 years? What expertise and what resources do we need to put in place to make sure that these young healthcare workers can train and be supported, and then obviously and then be remunerated appropriately?
That was Matthew Clark. We'll be back straight after this.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simple yet powerful website building platform. As a Guardian podcast listener, it goes without saying that you're a clever clogs. The good news is that building your own professional website with Squarespace is easy. Whether the site you need is for a small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog, getting started takes seconds. Go to squarespace.com today and show support for this podcast and get 10% off. Use the offer code Guardian.
You're listening to the Global Development Podcast. I'm Lisa O'Carroll. When you ask professionals working in Sierra Leone and Liberia what is causing the most problems, they often cite lack of resources, ranging from lack of protective clothing or supplies of basics like paracetamol, ambulances, even open hospitals. But an underlying issue also identified early on is the lack of trust in authorities, a hangover from the civil war. We heard earlier from Robtel Paley about the resonance the Ebola crisis has for those who lived through recent wars. Before we hear from her again, this is Tom Danat, founder and director of the British charity Street Child, who work exclusively in Sierra Leone and Liberia.
Sierra Leone is a very suspicious society. Stories that the father tells the son to sit in a wall and turn his back to him. I'll stand behind you, and just when you're ready, just rock back, and I'll catch you. And the son does as his father tells him to, and the father lets the son fall to the ground and hurt himself. And the son gets up and says, why did you do that, Dad? And the dad says to the father, I'm teaching you the most important thing you'll ever learn about life in Sierra Leone. Trust nobody. This is something I carry around with me, and I see it in my regular interactions with life in Sierra Leone. Trust is the commodity which is really at its lowest. That lack of trust, which creates a vacuum through which rumour swirls, makes it so hard for positive information to gain traction. It makes it very hard for businesses to operate, or even simple petty commerce on a local level.
I think a lot of investors are pulling out, or at least coming to a standstill. There have been issues with possible GDP growth slowing. I mean, I remember AFD, the African Development Bank, was saying that GDP growth this year that was estimated at maybe 6% would probably go down to 3% for Liberia. I don't remember what the estimates are for Sierra Leone.
For myself, the problem that's been really exposed is the chronic lack of education, the under-education of the population, particularly in the rural areas. We know that at least 250,000 children of primary school or going age in Sierra Leone don't go to school, and that number is probably near 500,000 in Liberia. As this disease has emerged and it is spread predominantly in rural areas, these are the areas which are the hardest for the public health messages to penetrate.
I think in terms of the education system, I mean, a few months ago, the president said that the education system was in a mess, which is a very damning evidence of her administration in terms of what it's invested in the education sector. Almost more than half of the entrants, the students who took the University of Liberia entrance exam failed, both the math and the English section. In terms of people's morale, I think I'm more concerned about that than the infrastructure or the economic aspects. But people had a sense of hope, I think, immediately after the war ended. I think there's a lot of despair and disillusionment at this stage, even before Ebola, I would say, became a national health emergency or an international health emergency, as the WHO says it is. I think people were suffering even before this Ebola outbreak came in. And I think now that the prices of commodities have gone up, people's livelihoods are being threatened. They're staying at home, but again, they don't know what tomorrow holds. So it's just a really trying time for the country.
Those that have received the least by way of services are those who are going to be the most skeptical and untrusting of messages that come from those that purport to serve them.
At the back of most people's minds is, yes, we're still disillusioned, yes, we're still angry, but the fact of the matter is we're in the moment now. We have to deal with this now. But those questions of, is the government really interested in my best interest, are not going to go away. But right now, I think it's trust under duress, if that makes any sense.
I think if we look specifically at what happened in West Point, when overnight West Point was quarantined in a unexpected and aggressive fashion led by Liberian military and armed security forces, certain civilians, including one of our own beneficiaries, were shot. Titus was shot by security forces. He turned up in our office in Monrovia, heavily bleeding, having tried to admit himself to two hospitals and being turned away. Our staff then helped him to be admitted to a third one.
I think that was a misstep from the very beginning, getting the armed forces of Liberia involved. You know, the government responded by saying that they're going to have an internal probe and they will investigate the matter. And if there's anyone culpable, they will find the culprit and he or she will be penalized.
And again, as an indication of how potentially explosive this incident was viewed by the political authorities, he's had, I believe, two personal visits from Sirleaf Johnson, the president of Liberia, and they handed over some cash, I think $1,000. He's saying he wants to be taken outside Liberia for proper medical care.
But I think using lethal force and using the armed forces without any warning whatsoever, I think was a really big misstep on the government's part. And, you know, the president has come, she sort of come back and said she apologized for the use of the AFL and realized that that was not the best course of action. And, I have to respect her for that. I think a leader who makes a mistake and is able to apologize and to acknowledge that that was a misstep is good, I think, in this particular instance. And sort of doubling back and saying, okay, what can we do to make the situation better? They lifted the quarantine on Dolos Town. They lifted the quarantine on West Point because they realized that that wasn't helping the situation in any way because people didn't have food to eat. They were scared that they couldn't leave. You know, the military was knocking on their doors and that just created more hysteria.
I think the sheer sort of desperation of the situation has forced political authorities and everyone to think, what can be done? Personally, I think only really in recent weeks can I put my hand on my heart and say that I feel that the international response has started to be driven by a concern for West Africans.
people on the ground in Liberia are demanding that the $5 million or $12 million that's been allotted to the Ebola task force to contain the disease, it's not being managed properly. Now, the national task force leader, Dobo Jala, came to, I think, a press conference at the end of August, and he had an expenditures report, and he was sort of telling us how the money had been expended. And there were all these questions about, where has the money gone? They've eaten the money. No, that's not what it's been used for. And even the finance minister had to come and have another press conference to assure people that the money has not disappeared. And I thought that that was a great step, that they actually were being accountable to the citizenry and coming forward and saying, this is how the money is being spent, even though, you know, questions are still being raised. But I think for me, a more telling accountability mechanism would also be for the international community to do the same thing. I mean, we're hearing pledges every day of these huge amounts of money. But the question that I have as a Liberian citizen is, how do we track this amount? I mean, where is it going? How is it being used? Is it going on really expensive consultants, or is it going for much needed life-serving medicine for the Liberian, Sierra Leonean, Guinean, and Nigerian people? So I think there also need to be accountability mechanisms for donors as well, so that they answer to their stakeholders as well as the people that they say they're fighting, you know, this war on Ebola for.
I think a general concern for public hygiene might be a silver lining from this whole episode. People are washing their hands like never before across Liberia and Sierra Leone, which is one of the ways of protecting oneself against Ebola, but is also a good way of protecting yourself against a variety of other things. Long term, the need to transform health provision is there, and it's clear. I hope that the need to transform education provision, people realise that these aren't just bad things for those people, but actually it presents a threat to everyone.
There's a report that said more than 50% of the people who are contracting Ebola are women, because they're the natural caregivers in homes, where people are still, even though they know that there's imminent threat, that they're still coming to the rescue of their fellow citizens. For me, post-Ebola, I think we need to sing these people's praises, and we need to tell their stories. I think that's so important.
Matthew Clark again.
I think that there is, as I said, a tremendous opportunity while we're focused on what has caused Ebola to actually try and tackle some of the underlying problems. And I think that at the minute, we're in the sort of humanitarian phase of the response to Ebola. So that's a lot about just going in and doing things, trying to treat patients, trying to isolate patients, trying to get the Ebola epidemic under control. I think that there's a tension always between the humanitarian emergency response and the kind of more sustainable development response, where you're trying to strengthen the healthcare system for the future. And I think historically, the international community hasn't been very good at that. They've been good at the kind of big bang response, which is effective at dealing with the humanitarian crisis, but does, to a certain extent, distorts the underlying health economy. And then making sure that we transition from that back to a sustainable path for development. If we can get that transition right, I think it's an incredible opportunity to actually really strengthen the healthcare systems across West Africa and actually move forward the progress that we need.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of the Global Development Podcast. Don't forget, you can have your say at theguardian.com/global-development. Just click the link to the podcast. My name is Lisa O'Carroll. The producer was Matt Hill. Until next time. Goodbye.
The Guardian.